Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for October 24th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast, and in it, Mozilla's new Open Web Apps initiative, how the Allies used math against German tanks in World War II, new tactics attackers are using to bypass network security, and barriers to real competition in the wake of the Google Book settlement. All of this and more. First, though, before I get started, I wanted to give a quick review of a new addition to our family game library. Longtime listeners know that my family and I enjoy tabletop gaming, card games, tile games, dice games, and the like. Anything that the entire family can play together that presents more of a challenge than your typical off-the-shelf offerings from the big box toy stores. We went a few weeks ago, me and the boys, to a local gaming convention and played out of the very generous and large library of a local gaming club, some stuff that they had on offer. And one game that really we took a shine to was Raw. This is a game by designed by Rainer Knizia. You may recognize that. He's designed any number of other very successful and very fun games. I'll include a link to the Board Game Geek entry on Raw. It is composed of a board with two tracks, one that drives three rounds of play and another that drives a bidding auction cycle. There are tiles for drawing, tablets for scoring, and tokens for use during those actual auctions, as well as a marker token to keep track of who was playing when an auction started. Our copy is actually a newer edition than the one we played at the con. It included a bag as well to put the draw tiles in. There also were some corrections to the rules that made them a bit clearer than the first time we played with that borrowed copy. This is a deceptively complex game. It takes more time to digest the rules than it does to actually play. Once you kind of get familiar, it plays surprisingly quickly, so much so that it's a lot more fun to come back to later. It's marked for 12 and up, but my 8-year-old son actually manages to play it pretty well. Now, he doesn't grasp all of the strategies inherent in how to approach the auctions and to bid with a limited number of bidding tiles, but he still enjoys it and he still engages with it very thoroughly. It's a collecting game that relies on, as I said, periodic auctions that are driven by the various tracks on the board, and the winner of these auctions has the potential reward of picking up a large number of tiles at one go. You have a limited number of what are called sun tokens with which to bid, and those are divvied up. Each has a unique number. So your strategy relies on picking when to bid each tile and when to pass to try to maybe hang on to some higher value tokens for use later on. We find that it takes far less than an hour to play. My older son especially enjoys the game for the artwork and the design. The mythological references are really well worked in. It's very gorgeous if you have any interest in Egyptology or Egyptian mythology. I think you'll get an extra level of enjoyment out of this game. Like a lot of games by European designers, as I said, it's incredibly attractive. It's a handsome set, very well constructed and put together, very durable. I expect that we'll have this one in our library and share it with our friends for many years to come. You can play it with as few as 2 people and up to 5. It is also entirely family-friendly, except maybe for the absolute youngest, who might be spooked a little bit by some of the disaster tiles. These are tiles that, when collected, wipe out some of the things that you've collected. And there is a funeral tile, so maybe if they're even younger than my 8-year-old, that might be upsetting to them. But I don't think there's anything otherwise very graphic or conceptually troubling about this game. If your kids are comfortable with the notion of mummies and what those are, then there's nothing in here that's really going to present anything concerning to you as a geek family. It makes for a slightly more involved than a casual game, but still, as I say, the gameplay, once you kind of get past digesting the rules, is very straightforward. It takes more brain power than, say, Flux or Zombie Dice, but not a lot more. So I think it's conducive to after-dinner conversation while playing this game, a really good way of rounding out an enjoyable family evening with friends. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. The Register describes new findings from security vendor Stonesoft. They were testing their new security appliance when they came across what they are calling Advanced Evasion Techniques, or AET. It builds on existing tricks where attackers carve up their payloads. The idea is that if a target system or the intervening network hardware doesn't normalize the packets at the internet protocol level, reassembling what's contained, then they are more likely to slip by any kind of scanners deployed at the network's perimeter that require that comprehensive look at the data flowing through. Given that defenders now are working harder to put these scattered pieces or fragments of attacks together, this ramps up that idea even further. It sounds like it's specific to the file sharing traffic or protocol. The article mentions mixing SMB sessions. SMB is the Windows file sharing network protocol. In other words, AET combines IP fragmentation at the lowest level data that I already described with scrambling it, I think, higher up in the stack where it's encoded as information specific to those higher level concerns. This sounds similar to what malware does once it's actually on a target system, on disk as it were, in terms of changing itself or using a polymorphic attack in order to evade the same sort of fingerprinting detection. Stonesoft submitted their finding to Finland's CERT-FI, as well as to an independent lab for verification. Stonesoft identified hardware-based security devices as being potentially the most vulnerable, mostly because they are harder or in some cases even impossible to upgrade to take this attack technique into account. I expect once CERT-FI issues their full advisory, those appliance vendors with patchable systems will provide updates. End-user systems aren't necessarily affected. AET is about obscuring attacks and route. There are different techniques that apply more when they actually get to servers and workstations. Remember that in order to be infectious, to be able to affect those kinds of computers, they have to assemble their payload once they arrive. And at that point, your usual sorts of anti-malware systems are going to be able to still be as effective. The Register also reported this past week that for 3.5 hours last Sunday, the U.S. website of Russian antivirus vendor Kaspersky Labs had been hijacked and was serving malware out to anyone unlucky enough to visit the site. Worse, when users complained, Kaspersky originally denied the problem. They did come clean on Tuesday, laying blame on an exploit in a third-party application on their servers. During the attack, the site redirected to an attacking page that launched a window designed to look like a virus scanner running on the local system that would then offer a download option on claiming to have found some sort of infection. The Register speculates that a system would only be affected if its user clicked on any of those download links, triggering an installation. This is actually a very common form of attack, taking over legitimate sites or setting up attractive shady sites and trying to fool a target into installing software, whether that's a multimedia codec, a downloadable game, or in this case, some defensive software. Sadly, this is just the latest such incident for Kaspersky Labs in particular, which has suffered a series of repeated compromise detailed in the Register piece. This one, unlike past attacks, apparently didn't directly compromise any customer data, so there wasn't a breach involved, but still 3.5 hours where people are trying to get legitimate tools and unfortunately being exposed is still pretty concerning. Regardless of Kaspersky's track record, this reminds us that even legitimate sites can harbor some risk, as they make for very attractive targets for these kinds of drive-by attacks. Trust your instincts when something seems suspicious, even if the domain name or the website is one you would otherwise trust. Here are the news stories that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website at thecommandline.net. Mozilla, in a move this week, is clearly looking to evolve the definition of what it means to be a web application. This is in response, obviously, to Google's Chrome Store announced back at Google I.O. and in anticipation of the Mac App Store announced this week and that I wrote about repeatedly up on the website. The emphasis, though, is on how web applications are packaged. Adding a JSON manifest makes them self-describing and hence installable. In the case of Mozilla's plan, installation means registering with a new client repository in the browser. In many ways, it seems similar to the plugin manager and the add-on manager already present. The difference is that open web apps only use web technology. That includes all of the advanced HTML5 capabilities, though, like local storage, advanced network sockets, and the like. The line between what a web application can do and what an add-on can do has been steadily blurring as HTML5 has brought more platform capabilities to bear. This new version of the still-in-flux standard directly supports rich applications right in the browser without the need for any native code access. Part of the announcement also discusses the idea of app stores. Mozilla isn't proposing to build a single app store, although undoubtedly they'll have one, and they have an experimental one to demonstrate the idea, but rather to leverage this new open web app standard as a means to enable anyone to set up their own stores and distribution mechanisms with whatever services and a variety that they might want to build on top. As they put it, stores can then compete on features like ratings, discussions, even paying for applications. They are trying to work out the hard parts that would need to underlie these stores, like security and authorization, especially with the idea of supporting payment in mind. Unlike other efforts we've seen, Mozilla's idea leaves room for self-installing applications as well. It's not laminated into this idea of distribution and the store. You can have a web app up on a website with this manifest, and it can just install the same way that you can put an add-on out there or a theme today and serve that off of your own site. This is like Android in that there can be multiple stores, but you can also go directly to a developer's site to install a package. The client-side repository will also go beyond just merely managing and launching applications. Future exploration will include consolidated notifications and search across apps. Once again, I admire Mozilla for their dedication to open standards. Open web apps will work across all browsers. This is not specific to Firefox. Some covering this, like Marshall Kirkpatrick at ReadWrite Web, are focusing solely on the App Store part of the story. This is understandable given the cachet that stores have with mobile platforms and the news, as I said, that Mac OS X will be getting an app store in its next major update. I also get the point that there is a gap here. Where do regular users get software these days? I cannot remember the last time I was in a computer retail store. Do people still purchase shrink wrap software off the shelf? Does your average user know about some of the more popular online stores and distribution points? How many people do you know who only use the bundled crapware that comes with the PCs they bought? The idea of open competing app stores could change that, bringing software discovery right alongside the browser itself, something that I think everybody has access to and knowledge of. I think it still remains to be seen if ordinary users will accept thinking about web applications like regular old installable desktop applications. That is the more interesting question to me. The fact that Mozilla and everyone else is making an app store play, regardless of how they all differ, says that this model is going to be here at least for a little while. Mozilla's open web apps are intended to integrate to work like desktop apps, but only use web technologies in doing so. Prism is Mozilla's project to provide a desktop application wrapper around web apps. Open web apps could potentially make use of Prism. It would seem to be a complementary move, although I didn't dig deep enough to see if that's actually part of the plan. Part of me is thrilled at this idea, as I think it combines with the cheap and easy server platforms that have been around for a while now. I think we need killer apps that go beyond what we're seeing already with these notions like email, social networks, and the few other examples people cite. Desktop apps are, I think, still unlikely to go away, but for applications that are by their nature networked, always on, this could be the shape of the future. Unlike offerings from Google, Apple, and elsewhere, this is sample code, open to view and to hack, as well as providing examples. I've been intensely interested in the material graphene since I first read about it. Laid out in a hexagonal arrangement, it is composed of a single layer of carbon atoms. It's the stuff from which carbon nanotubes are actually made. In sheet form, it has some very interesting electrical properties. Slashdot links to a Computer World article that talks about some new efforts around using this material for information storage and computing at the same time. Roland Kawakami and his research team at the University of California, Riverside, have demonstrated a compelling breakthrough based on earlier work with graphene. Their system also builds on the field of spintronics, another trend I've been following in the possible future physics of computing. Instead of using electrical current for storing information, these systems use another property, spin. Technically, their approach is called tunneling spin injection because it injects an electron with a specific spin state into the resisting substrate provided by the ordered lattice of carbon atoms. Theoretically, once a particle is imparted with spin, either in the notional up or down direction, that spin will remain without the need to apply more energy, unlike using electrical current. Applications to date have understandably been much more focused on pure storage, especially non-volatile applications comparable to how we use flash RAM, but with much higher densities than spinning drives or NAND chips. The researchers at UCR, however, showed that computation could actually be combined in place with the information storage in the particle spin. Spinning electrons are injected, as I said, into the graphene, and then can be toggled using, I think it's a ferromagnetic electric field, toggling their up and down states, much like the bits in a traditional computer. The team has overcome some obstacles in proving the duration of imparted spin. In practice, the spin states degrade far more quickly than they anticipated. By adding an insulating layer between the graphene and the injector, they've already shown a marked improvement in the lifetime of these spin states, so how long they can actually hang on to information. Kawakami is conservative in his estimates in the article, saying this technology may be practical in 5 years, and then a first commercial applications another 5 years after that. All the same, his team is already working with engineers to develop the necessary supporting circuitry to go alongside the injectors. The biggest remaining challenge will be to shrink the size of all of it and the power then required to inject the spin electrons and to affect their state once they're stable in the graphene. If this can be accomplished, it will both drastically cut power requirements and speed up compute time, something like 1,000-fold, the article states, would be apparent comparable to clock speed, to the frequency of CPUs. I don't think that it's directly comparable in terms of how it's implemented, but in terms of how people make these kind of relative comparisons. The main reason for the speed up is that computation and memory will take place in the same physical place on the die rather than being separate systems and suffering from what the article describes as the von Neumann bottleneck, that is the time it to the differential really to go to a slower system like main RAM. The fact that the spin states are non-volatile also means that a computer using this approach would turn on essentially instantly, resuming immediately from its power to off state. You can think of this really like ramping up the registers already available to a CPU, which right now are pretty limited, and it's where information gets shuttled not only from main RAM, as I said, but also from disk. But if you made those capacious enough to store enough data to replace main memory and potentially even replace storage, so everything's right there on the CPU, then you start to get a sense of why this is so exciting. Kawakami thinks that in 10 years, as I said, this might reduce the power requirements of computers such that you might never need to turn them off at all, that they would just be able to run and maintain whatever idle state with just the merest trickle of energy. Kawakami emphasizes how early this research is. He actually likens it to the transition from vacuum tubes at the start of computing several decades ago to electronic transistors, which is actually also a pretty big leap. There's still work to be done, like developing just a spin-based transistor so they don't even necessarily have all of the components they need, but the principles here seem sound, and that's what they're demonstrating and what makes this so tremendously exciting. World War II interests me because the births of modern computing and cryptology are inextricably bound up in it. When I saw this Wired piece by Ray Wirt, I assumed it had something to do with code-breaking efforts or primitive computer simulations. This is the story about how the Allies use math against German tanks. As it turns out, the story is even simpler than that, but in some ways a bit more interesting. At its crux was this question of how many tanks the Germans were actually producing each month. The Allies were interested in the question because they felt the German tanks were of superior capability, so the question of how the numbers stacked up was key to use of Allied machines against them. Traditional means of intelligence apparently produced estimates that were simply too high to match the observed forces at key battles. The solution to the discrepancy actually is similar to code-breaking efforts. cracking the encrypted communications of the enemy often relied on cribs, observed facts that were not encrypted but related to those protected messages. Clues often arose from patterns of data, not just single pieces. Here the clue was derived from the serial numbers on the tanks. Piecing together enough samples, a sequential pattern was deduced. The article even gives the formula used to calculate from a maximum sequential ID and a number of observed tanks the number of units produced in a month from that. After the war ended, it was possible to actually go back and confirm the estimate of 255 tanks a month, which was one off from the actual number of 256. There's a lesson for securing modern systems in here, I think. Sequential numbers are used to identify a lot of things, especially online when dealing with user data, electronic orders, and the like. That's before we even get into the role of generated numbers for modern cryptography. Many breaks of crypto systems have arisen from cracking how parameters are actually generated, rather than attacking the math or aspects of the code head-on. If the Germans had used a harder-to-guess scheme, then the Allies would not have been able to reverse-engineer the production rate. Maybe the net effect would not have been all that great, but in such a huge conflict, it could have resulted in dragging some battles out and changing casualty rates for the worse. For network security, arbitrary identifiers likewise may not seem all that important until an attacker is able to reverse engineer keys for pass orders and combine that with other exploits to snag your user's data. This story is a vivid and clear reminder of how to think about the mundane parts of a system that might be exposed to unknown adversaries, and a pretty good endorsement of the value of basic mathematics and numeracy to critical endeavors of all kinds. Mind-machine interfaces are an abiding trope in science fiction, especially cyberpunk, one of my favorite genres within that. In the past year, there have been more stories about research bringing these to life using non-invasive techniques like EEGs. Whether the uptick has been due to an improvement in the available sensors or the increased quantity of sheer computing horsepower, this technology is even making its way into toys. I was immediately taken by a Wired article by Scott Thill showing what one musician is doing at the intersection of DIY and punk with these. Robert Schneider, singer and guitarist of Apples in Stereo, has hacked a MindFlex toy, which ordinarily uses its EEG to control a fan that lifts and lowers a hollow ball through a rotating maze. He's crafted an instrument, what he calls the Teletron, from a couple of these toys, hooking them up to vintage synthesizers, which adds a whole other level of cool for folks who are into synthesized music. There are a couple of videos at the article at Wired showing the fruits of his labor. The first is a simple demonstration of just using feedback and the EEGs to increase and decrease pitch generated out of the synthesizer. He admits the result may not be musical as such, but it definitely has potential demonstrating the power of feedback. I could see the simple output of this toy EEG coupled with some of the rather impressive sonification tools that I've read about and discussed on the website in the past handful of months, or using that one stream of data to augment performances with traditional instruments, hooking into an automated drum or loop machine responding to the performer's mood or their perception of the audience's emotional state. I think they're really just touching on the tip of the iceberg with this demo and this kind of homebrew hack. In the second video, Schneider and folks in Louisville, Kentucky's Level 1 hackerspace explore the idea a little further. Schneider and experimental keyboardist Robert Beatty tweak the synthesizers live hooked up to the Teletron, while Level 1's Chris Sprek is hooked up to the EEGs of the toys and reads some passages and poetry that were prepared beforehand by Schneider. Phil provides some good background, too, on this field of brain music that actually goes back a ways. This is not necessarily a new effort. It's continuous with efforts before. But clearly, with an $80 toy that other makers and modders have taken apart, the field has become that much more accessible, so it's possible we may see a flowering of exploring these ideas in different applications. I can easily see crossovers here from circuit bending and the chip tuning scenes, applying these sensors as they become cheaper. The cheap EEGs may have too poor temporal resolution right now to do anything like driving something as sophisticated as a guitar or a piano, but they certainly prove a concept and are only limited by the hacker's ingenuity, and it's possible that that resolution may get better I have to imagine as the higher end units become commercially available, some of the ones really aimed more at dealing with impairments and disabilities, that some brain musicians will lay hands on some of those and really push the envelope. Inevitably, I think the technology will probably trickle down into the cheaper toy market too, as the cost of production starts to drop. That would then open up even more possibilities for the DIY and punk brain musicians. There's just something primal and appealing about the notion of potentially being able to tap into our very consciousness and hear it as rich, maybe chaotic, but certainly complex music. And the feedback loop that is central to cybernetics is inescapable. The performance will feed back into the mood and attention of the wired performer, forming a crazy, strange loop that will undoubtedly thrill today's most experimental and out there musicians. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've discussed before. I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. Technology Review points to some analysis done by Eric M. Fraser, a legal expert whose work was published in the Stanford Law Review. The Google Books settlement is still under review by the Department of Justice. The whole process has been protracted, and there haven't been any developments in months. In the past, the settlement terms have been debated and delayed. Currently, the DOJ is expressing monopoly concerns over the deal. That is very much the takeaway from Fraser's work. The way the settlement stands now, Google has an exclusive right to orphan works. These are works that may still be in copyright, but whose rights holders cannot be found. This is a problem that they would be able to lay claim to these when no other party can get access to them. This leads to a monopoly power over pricing of these works, and as physical copies become scarcer, the Technology Review author thinks that that will only strengthen Google's monopoly position. Basically, it'll close off anybody else's ability to physically redigitize the same works. The worst is that in practice, the only way for another company to get similar access is to actually undertake that digitization work that has proven so problematic. It's arguably illegal. This is the crux of this settlement. And they would have to basically do it, have a lawsuit press, and then either seek a finding or come to some settlement that would grant them access on some terms that are agreeable to both parties. There's no guarantee that somebody else trying the same thing that Google did will yield a similar result to Google's deal, as problematic as that deal is. The author points out that this is a consequence of the current overly broad state of copyright. It's something that I follow with interest quite a bit throughout this show. Earlier discussions around the book settlement sparked some interest in orphan works legislation, but nothing so far has come of it. The points of interest in the article also resonate with the recent findings by the Library of Congress. That was on the state of audio archiving, but still, that notion of access and how we get at works that are increasingly hard to get to. Even if we cannot agree on personal use rights under copyright, can we at least start to agree that orphan works need to be addressed in a way that doesn't hand them over part and parcel to one company, regardless of our estimation of how that company may behave for good or ill? I think it's well past time that we get some workable orphan works legislation stood up and moving forward through the process. A few weeks ago, I talked about the formation of the Document Foundation and LibreOffice, its fork of OpenOffice.org. The move was prompted by Oracle's less than stellar track record with open source and concerns over the fate of the cross-platform Office productivity suite, seen as a key alternative to the proprietary option of Microsoft Office. This in the wake of Oracle's acquisition of Sun, who had holdings in OpenOffice.org. OpenOffice.org has also been a big driver of open document formats, making them available and useful by many other open source and free software projects, so it's not just about the software tool itself. One question outstanding at the time when that story broke was Oracle's reaction. Would they play ball or would they wall off the Document Foundation folks? They most definitely have refused the request by the new foundation for access to the trademarks. That's why it's LibreOffice. Oracle still has the trademark OpenOffice.org. The database giant has also declined to formally join the Document Foundation. If that wasn't clear enough, Ryan Paul at Ars Technica reported this past week that Oracle has asked members of the new foundation to leave the OpenOffice.org Community Council. The OpenOffice.org community manager told the Document Foundation members their participation in no uncertain terms in the new organization represents a conflict of interest. The choice presented was either or, not necessarily to leave the community council. Paul interprets this, and I think correctly, that Oracle sees LibreOffice as a hostile fork. That's kind of contrary to the stated position, however, of the Document Foundation. I read one statement, a commenter, I think it was actually Charles Sauls, who was very heavily involved with this, likening that sort of interpretation to Debian asking members of its project employed by Canonical, who makes Ubuntu, which is based on Debian, to make a decision between those two projects based on a conflict of interest. There's definitely a strong cooperation between Debian and Ubuntu. Neither would do half as well without the other. And I think that's a healthy attitude of the Document Foundation folks, that they want to see it that same way. It's unfortunate that Oracle doesn't agree. To be fair, the Document Foundation and LibreOffice are so new, it's hard to say that's how the relationship would have worked as much as they try to set it up and position it that way. It seems impossible now that we'll find out, now that Oracle's essentially stonewalled them. Oracle's actions will make it unlikely there will be good upstream-downstream cooperation between the two projects, which, as I say, is a shame. I would put my money, though, long-term on the Document Foundation and LibreOffice. By Oracle severing ties like this, I think they've lost touch with any goodwill they could have claimed here with regards to the larger open-source and free software communities. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I'd like to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend, or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next episode, which should go out in the feed Wednesday night, will be my interview, my long-anticipated interview with cyberpunk and transreal author Rudy Rucker. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.